This is the last, let me get over on this side. This is the last of the series of 4 weeks on Bonhoeffer's theology through his poetry. My hope is, I told you the very first week, Lucy Van Pelt and I had kind of a similar attitude about poems. Poets tell us that the answers to life can be found in the stars. Stupid poets. Over the course of this study, my attitude has changed somewhat. I was telling Bob earlier, I still read some poems and end up thinking, what? But yet there is a rich possibility of sharing faith and theology and matters of the spirit in very personal ways through poetry. John writes poems. Anybody else in here a writer of poetry? If you are, you would probably understand what I'm saying. Bonhoeffer certainly was. And as I had said the very first week we are together, it's probably no coincidence that he did not start writing poems until he was in the heaviest crisis of his life, namely when he was in prison. The 10 poems that he wrote were only written during those years in prison, which I've said over and over again. It was a time of exploration and introspection. We don't really know why he started writing his poems there. He never said. But you can guess and speculate some of that. And if you read his poems, there is certainly what I just got done saying, that there is a rich possibility of sharing his faith and reflecting. The poem that this series is named after, Who Am I, that is a poem of wrestling with who he is as a child of God. And all of those poems, though they begin in a very questioning, sometimes despairing way, like a psalm of lament, inevitably end in a word of hope, also like a psalm of lament. If you actually hung in there and read all of Night Visions in Tegel, that is page after page of reflection of the kinds of negative things he saw in prison, but the very last stanza, he comes back to a word of hope. So, a couple of reminders of some of the theology of the last 2 weeks, and then we'll leap into today's poems. The poem, Who Am I, wrestled with theological themes such as identity as God's child, the very name of the poem, Who Am I? And Dave made a wonderful point, I never thought of it, but it was a wonderful point, that Bonhoeffer asks a series of questions in that poem, but the only one he answers is the last time, when he says, Who am I? Whoever I am, O Lord, thou knowest I am thine. That's the only question he answers in that whole poem. Never caught that before in all the times I'd read it, because that is, whatever else is true of us, that is where our identity resides. He also wrestled, if you read that poem, which we did last week, with the outward persona versus the inward reality. It's not often that people know the crisis we're experiencing inside because we just don't share that. And that's what he was wrestling with, if you recall. Some of the things he was talking about, portraying this demeanor of being strong, but inside he was a contemptibly woebegone weakling, is how he described himself. Christians and Pagans, which was the shortest of his poems, deals with essentially three theological themes. One of them, remember that Greek word, metanoia, it simply means repentance or conversion. That fundamentally is what Christians need to go through, a conversion from living for the self to living for God. And that happens through accepting forgiveness, that we are sinners in need of God, but we are forgiven sinners. Whenever I introduce the prayer of confession, one of the things I often say is, as forgiven and reconciled people, let us confess our sins before God. And that's why. Because we don't confess our sins in a vacuum, nor to an angry God, but to a God who's forgiven us. And that's the key, the crux of the ability to be converted. And then the final thing that poem talks about, there's a sequence in that poem where he talks about standing by God, that for him, the difference between a religious person, which was for Bonhoeffer often used pejoratively, religious people were people that got all the details correct, but their heart was not correct. The kind of thing Amos was talking about when he railed against the synagogues and the worship. You got all the jots and tittles correct, but you're doing nothing to really connect with God. And for Bonhoeffer, the difference between a religious person and a Christian is someone who expects God to do a bunch of stuff for them over against that person who would like God to do a bunch of stuff for them, but at the same time stands by God in God's suffering, in his need, recognizing when God sees need in the world, there is pain there, and standing by God by standing by others. So those were the themes in that really short poem. This was his last poem. We're going to actually be singing it in just a minute. I want to give a couple of words of introduction to this poem. And then if time presents itself, I will read it as our concluding reading today. But I wanted to hit it early while Sarah was still here so she could play for us. This poem was not written in Tegel, if you notice. All of his poems were written in Tegel except for this one. Prince Albrechtstrasse was a prison that was actually the Gestapo headquarters, and they kept well-known, particularly famous prisoners in its basement. It was not a pleasant place to, well, no prison's a pleasant place to be, but this of the prisons was not a pleasant place to be. When he was here, he wrote By Powers of Good. Shortly after writing this, the Nazis began moving prisoners from prison to prison to keep them ahead of the Allies, because by this time they had a pretty good idea it was all over. They were still fighting, but they pretty much knew the Allies were pressing in on them and they were going to be losing. And so they began moving famous prisoners so that when the Allies came in, they could not catch these, they could not restore these famous prisoners to freedom and then hear the story of what the Nazis had done. This was the last poem he wrote before he was executed. This was written just before Christmas in 1944. He was executed in April of 1945, and between those two times, he was in several prisons, finally ending up in Flossenbürg, where he was hanged. I've talked about his fiancée, Maria von Wedemeyer. I mentioned this book the first week we were together, Love Letters from Cell 92. That was his cell number in Tegel. This is a wonderful book. If you read Cost of Discipleship or any of Bonhoeffer's books, you don't necessarily get a sense of the tenderness that is in here. He loved Maria and she loved him. And early on, as I told you the first week, they were convinced that he was going to be out of prison and they were making plans for their future together. It was only later that it became clear they were never going to see each other outside of prison again. He was actually dead for some time before she or any of his family knew that he had even been executed. This poem he wrote as a part of a letter to her and sent it to her as a kind of Christmas present. And in that letter, which was written December 19th of 1944, I'm just going to read a couple of comments that he made. My dearest Maria, I have often found that the quieter my surroundings, the more vividly I sense my connection with you all. It's as if in solitude the soul develops organs of which we're hardly aware in everyday life. So I haven't for an instant felt lonely and forlorn. Remember where he is when he's writing this. You yourself, my parents, all of you, including my friends and students on active service, are my constant companions. Your prayers and kind thoughts, passages from the Bible, long-forgotten conversations, pieces of music, books, all are invested with life and reality as never before. I live in a great unseen realm of whose real existence I'm in no doubt. The old children's songs about the angel says, two to cover me, two to wake me. And today we grown-ups are no less in need than children of preservation night and morning. Anyway, what do happiness and unhappiness mean? They depend so little on circumstances and so much more on what goes on inside us. I'm thankful every day to have you, you and all of you, And that makes me happy and cheerful. In prison when he wrote that. If you turn in the hymnals to page number 818, this poem is probably one of the better known of his poems because it was set to music a number of times, this being one of them. And so, first of all, thank you to Sarah for being willing to accompany us. She is going to play this hymn through once, and then we're going to sing the whole hymn. And I would invite you to really, as much as you, I know an unfamiliar hymn, it may be till the second verse till you're actually able to focus on the words, and I understand that. But try to focus on the words while you're singing it as well, because this is what Bonhoeffer said in that last poem, and then I'll read it later on. So, Sarah, if you would play that once for us, please. Get into visions in Tegel in a minute. We're going to be looking at some of the eschatological hope that we've talked about, the hope that there is something beyond, something to look forward to. The slaves in the 19th century had a very strong sense of eschatological hope. Songs like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot look forward beyond the time of pain and despair that they are currently experiencing and holding themselves in that hope that God is there to meet them. It's the kind of thing the psalmist talks about too. Though I pass through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. The word is through. The psalmist sees a time beyond the valley, a time of hope beyond the valley of the shadow of death. So there's this constant looking forward. And that really is all that big, highfalutin word eschatological means. It means the ability to look ahead and to find our hope in God, even when today's circumstances don't seem to bear much hope. Yet when again in this same world you give us the joy we had, the brightness of your Son, we shall remember all the days we lived through, and all our whole life shall then be yours alone. A theme through all of his poems is not only that notion of looking ahead in hope, but is also knowing that all is God's, because that's why there is hope. His hope for the future is rooted in his belief that no matter what happens, God is his God and loves him and will care for him. I always find that amazing, given where he was. The same thing, if you read Paul's letters when he's in prison, and some of the wonderful, rejoice in the Lord always, again I say rejoice, he's writing that from prison. And it's just an amazing concept, I think, to be aware that even in times of despair and pain, we can cling to God's hope and in that find reason to go on. I find that indicting to me personally because I've never known those kinds of trials. I hope if I do, when I do, that I will be able to experience that same kind of hope. And I have a better shot at it because there are witnesses like this. So that's fundamentally, I think, what runs through all of his poems is that kind of eternal hope. Night Visions in Tegel, if you want to pull that out, that's the six-pager. Would anybody like to read the whole thing? We can do that. We're not going to do that. I just want to read some from the beginning and some from the end because the stuff in the middle is important. I would invite you to read it sometime, but it echoes what he talks about at the very beginning. It's on page 6 of your poetry packet. Imagine him laying on his cot, which is how he opens the poem, and these are reflections of what he's seeing and hearing from his cot. He begins by saying, "Stretched out on my cot, I stare at the gray wall. Outside, a summer evening that does not know me goes singing into the countryside. Slowly and softly, the tides of the day ebb on the eternal shore. Sleep a little. Strengthen body and soul, head and hand for peoples, houses, spirits, and hearts are aflame. Till your day breaks, after blood-red night, stand fast." That's a theme running through this. That's his nugget of eschatological hope. No matter what's happening, stand fast. Hold on. Night and silence. I listen. Only the steps and cries of the guards, the distant, hidden laughter of two lovers. Do you hear nothing else, lazy sleeper? I hear my own soul tremble and heave. Nothing else? I hear the silent night thoughts of my fellow sufferers asleep or awake, as if voices, cries, as if shouts for planks to save them. I hear the uneasy creak of the beds. I hear chains. And he talks about how he hears the whimpers of the young, and he hears the almost hopeful sense of the old who are looking forward to their execution because it will free them from this. And he talks toward the end of the poem about laying there and hearing footsteps and not knowing what it is and then realizing it's somebody going to their execution. And so on page 11, he comes to the end of the poem and he says this. I'm at the very bottom, the last last 7 lines. The first light of morning creeps through my window, pale and gray. A light, warm summer wind blows over my brow. Summer day, I will only say, beautiful summer day. What may it bring to me? Then I hear outside hasty, muffled steps. Near me they stop suddenly. I turn cold and hot, for I know, oh, I know. A soft voice reads something cuttingly and cold. Control yourself, brother. Soon you'll have finished it. Soon, soon. It's going to his execution. I hear you stride bravely and with proud step. You no longer see the present, you see the future. He's already, whoever it is, he can't, doesn't know who it is, but whoever is going to their death, they've made that transition. Their sole focus is on that eschatological hope. I go with you, brother, to that place, and I hear your last word. A theme throughout all of his poems is his solidarity with others, that our Christian faith is only complete when it's lived in relationship with other people. And I hear your last word. Brother, when the sun turns pale for me, then live for me. We go on when others can't. Stretched out on my cot, I stare at the gray wall. Outside, a summer morning, which is not yet mine, goes brightly into the countryside. Brother, till after the long night our day breaks, we stand fast. How easy, I think, it would be to not stand fast in times like that, to become despairing, to just basically give up, emotionally and spiritually, if not physically. But the message is to stand fast in the midst of all of that. And that's what is at the core of the eschatological hope, because there's a certain notion, there have been religious groups who have lived that eschatological hope by just looking to the future. I remember people have dated when the end of the world was going to come, and there have been groups that have just gone to the mountainside to wait for it to happen. Bonhoeffer would have said you've disconnected yourself from the faith, because the faith and that eschatological hope is only meaningful when you live in the reality of God's love now, no matter what's happening. But to disconnect yourself from that is to disconnect yourself from that which is faith. And that's what he's talking about here when he's talking about stand fast. Not just wistfully yearn for what is to come, although I'm sure he did wistfully yearn, but at the very same time, to live for others. That's a message through all of his poems. That kind of engagement is necessary. It's the kind of thing that a theologian, some of you may remember, I think it was Barth, but I'm not sure which theologian it was, talked about us living between the now and the not yet. And that's what Bonhoeffer was talking about. That phrase is not his, but it's that kind of thing that he was talking about, that we live now with the hope of the not yet, the future, but this is where the work is done, here. And this is where God has placed us. It's the kind of thing, and I hear your last word, brother, when the sun turns pale for me, then live for me. When whoever it is that's going down those steps to his execution is gone, then Bonhoeffer and those left behind, it's for them to continue living and to continue being faithful. That the only real final surrender is giving up. And so they need to stand fast. One of the commentators on that poem, his name was Philip Ziegler. What may still be Philip Ziegler. I don't know if he's still living. He said this: the Christian, unlike the devotees of the redemption myths, has no last line of escape available from earthly tasks and difficulties into the eternal. But like Christ himself, he must drink the earthly cup to the dregs, and only in his doing so is the crucified and risen Lord with him. And he is crucified and risen with Christ. In the same way that Easter is fairly meaningless apart from Good Friday, there'd be nothing to rise from if he hadn't died in the first place, the same thing is true in our faith. Suffering is not something we look forward to, but is often part and parcel of what we go through. And to continue standing fast in the midst of that is so very important. So those are the two theological themes, I think, in this particular poem. One is eschatological hope. The other is the hope leading to full engagement rather than a full retreat from life. You know, there are two ways of looking at it, I think. Eschatological hope can lead us to go into full retreat because we're going to make it. We've got a hope in the future, so we don't need to do a whole lot now. Or Bonhoeffer says what it needs to do is lead us into full engagement. That hope is real regardless of what we do. God's not going to take it away. But yet, to fully live into our faith means to fully live into our faith and to be in full engagement. When he writes in Cost of Discipleship, when Christ calls a man, forgiven the gender-specific language, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. That's what he's talking about, that sometimes our faith calls us into the fire, not away from it. But we don't go into it alone. And that's something is also a message of his, because we always, always, always have that hope. God will not let us down nor let us go. And that's just such a powerful thing. There's a hymn, O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, our shelter from the stormy blast and our eternal home. Under the shadow of thy throne, still may we dwell secure. Sufficient is thine arm alone, and our defense is sure. Before the hills in order stood, or earth received her frame, from everlasting thou art God, to endless years the same. 1,000 ages in thy sight are like an evening gone. Short as the watch that ends the night before the rising sun. Time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all who breathe away. They fly forgotten as a dream dies at the opening day. O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, be thou our guide while life shall last and our eternal home. That's the kind of thing that Bonhoeffer's talking about. Accepting God as our guide while life shall last, while knowing and accepting and affirming and thanking God for it, that he's also our eternal home. That's the kind of thing that he talks about in that poem, I think. We have two more poems, Stations on the Road to Freedom, in just a minute, and then I'll come back to read the poem we just sang. I want to open it up for any discussion we may have on this particular poem and on the notion of eschatological hope and on the notion of maybe how hard it is to live as Christians in today's world. But only to point out first, the hymn I just read is also a poem. I become aware, I guess since I've been living with Bonhoeffer's work for the past number of months, we're surrounded by poems, whether we know it or not. Every time we sing a hymn, there's a poem that we're singing and affirming our faith. So it's just kind of something I'd like to remind myself of and wanted to share it with you. Let's stop there for just a minute before we go on to Stations on the Road to Freedom and see what comments do you have about Night Voices in Tegel or about his concept of there being hope in the future that is really only fully meaningful. It's always fully present, but it's fully meaningful when we engage in life today, regardless what life holds. That's where his theology is rooted. Any thoughts about any of that, or about the words of the poem, particularly if you read it all between last week and this? Anybody? Okay. Then let's take a look at Stations on the Road to Freedom. This is really a cool poem. This was written in July of 44 in Tegel. Observe, it's on page 12 and 13 in your packets. Observe, first of all, how he structured this poem. Discipline, there are four stanzas. One, two, three, yeah, four. Discipline is one, action another, suffering a third, and the final one is death. This is another poem that deals with eschatological hope. It's kind of interesting to speculate, and if any of you know, that would be interesting to know as well. As he gets closer and closer to what will be his final end, and less certain he's ever going to get out of prison, this theme of eschatological hope shows up more profoundly. There may be absolutely nothing in that, but just my whimsy, but it's possible that's what's driving that, because he's wrestling with how to live as a Christian in a dangerous world while at the same time holding on to our faith in what is yet to come. Let me read the poem. It's not very long, so I'm going to read the entire poem and think about it. And I'm going to stop and ask if we could reflect a little bit after I've read it, before I say anything about it, why he chose those four category headers, why the stanzas are headed that way, and is there a progression? Does he suggest a progression among those four things? First is discipline. If you set out to seek freedom, then learn above all things to govern your soul and your senses, for fear that your passions and longing may lead you away from the path you should follow. Chaste be your mind and your body, and both in subjection, obediently, steadfastly seeking the aim set before them. Only through discipline may a man learn to be free. Action. Daring to do what is right, not what fancy may tell you, valiantly grasping occasions, not cravenly doubting, freedom comes only through deeds, not through thoughts taking wing. Faint not, nor fear, but go out to the storm and the action, trusting in God, whose commandment you faithfully follow. Freedom, exultant, will welcome your spirit with joy. Suffering. A change has come indeed. Your hands, so strong and active, are bound. In helplessness now you see your action is ended. You sigh in relief, your cause committing to stronger hands. So now you may rest contented. Only for one blissful moment could you draw near to touch freedom. Then, that it might be perfected in glory, you gave it to God. And finally, death. Come now, thou greatest of feasts, on the journey to freedom eternal. Death, cast aside all the burdensome chains and demolish the walls of our temporal body, the walls of our souls that are blinded, so that at last we may see that which here remains hidden, freedom. How long we have sought thee in discipline, action, and suffering. Dying, we now may behold thee revealed in the Lord. Before I say anything about it, let's us interpret this a little bit. What is Bonhoeffer saying? Why did he pick those four subject headers, if you want a place to hook on? Why are those four things important? There's no quiz. Go ahead.
How he lived his life. I think in the beginning, he was just like a regular guy. I mean, he was, they lived an upper class life. Mm-hmm. He was very well educated and all of that. And then he started to see some things. And it led him into action. I love where it says, freedom comes only through deeds, not through thoughts taking wing. And I think, you know, in my own life, I'm always thinking of, you know, how things ought to be. But if there's no action on my part, then it's a big waste of time. And I think that had to be how he thought. So he did his action, but then it cost him. So as soon as he started to show himself, then over the year, it didn't take that long really, but over the years, it all started to come in on him, and he was able to take action. Now, I love what he says, though, for one blissful moment, could you draw near to touch freedom? And then it's like, okay, now I have done this, and I just have to give it over. I just have to give it. And then, of course, in the end, there's death. I think I love him in The Cost of Discipleship. He talks about this idea of cheap grace. And anyone who's read that book knows that that's really kind of the theme of it. And I'm hearing that in the action section here. It's saying, you know, freedom comes only through deeds, not through thoughts taking wing. You act, you do. And he did, and he died. So...
Wow. Thank you. That's really cool. So you see this kind of a progression, what he's doing there.
Very much. Okay. And at first, he's just kind of on the edge. And he's in the whole way.
So it kind of moves to death.
Yeah.
Cool. Anybody else? Bob, please, go ahead.
Discipline in itself, if you don't react to it, I guess, or if you don't respond to it, gaining out of it doesn't necessarily lead to action.
So it's kind of like discipline to do No, fill in the blank. It's not just discipline for its sake. Cool. Thank you, Bob.
Debbie. And then Ted. Interesting that he's in prison, and in every stanza there's the word freedom.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he wanted to be free, no matter how it was going to happen.
Yeah.
He needed to be free.
It's quite amazing. Those that witness, there's a, I read somewhere in this preparation, somebody that witnessed the execution said he really had the man of someone at peace and free. I'm not sure I could, pardon me? Somebody who witnessed the Bonhoeffer's execution said that he really had the appearance of somebody who was free, who was at peace. I think I'd be scared to death. Yeah. Ted.
I thought that the section on death, which, you know, embraces it as that freedom, is interesting, but it's kind of challenging in our current culture, where even in the hymnal, the hymn that you read, Our God, Our Help in Ages Past, they soft pedals the words about death in the newest edition, where instead of saying, time like an ever-rolling stream soon bears us all away, you know, in other words, death is inevitable, they've shifted it to bears all our years away, just so we don't feel it's safe we're going to die. People don't like that so much. We have a tough time wrapping our brain around the concept of death.
It's a lot of denial that goes on in our culture, not maybe necessarily in other cultures, but yes, thank you, Ted. Others? John, please.
It looks like it's the four stages of freedom. You know, you start out with freedom, we all start out, we want what we want, ourselves, self-centered. And then we find out that we can't get that by ourselves, there are others involved, and so we get into the storm of the action and involve ourselves with others, and that's the action part. But then if you really do that and follow the commandment of God, you're going to get into trouble. And that's the suffering part, where you find that there's a price, the cost of discipleship. The cost of discipleship is way beyond anything you ever conceived of. And then death is where you realize, you finally learn, that freedom can only come when you are united with God and with others. And that's the final stage that you couldn't have possibly known unless you went through the other two.
Cool. Thank you. See, you get these poems. This is cool. Jeff, please.
Do you think today that any one like Bonhoeffer would have ever had the time to do this? Would he have been so involved with cell phones and TV?
Oh, that's
and
a good question.
Videos and everything else. The age of electronics. Would anyone have ever taken the time to sit down and think about all these things and come up with these solutions? Or would he be scanning the internet, looking for other people and their ideas and things like that? I just, I'm not sure that someone today could come up with these kinds of thoughts.
I'd never thought of that. That's interesting. Provided they had the use of the technology. The question is, would somebody today, given our connectivity, that we're always connected with something somewhere, would we be able to have the reflection that Bonhoeffer had? Is that the kind of thing?
Yeah.
What do you think? I don't want to go off on a tirade about technology, so I'll let you do that. What are your thoughts? Does the let me reframe it. Does the technology today make it less likely that we're going to be reflective in the way that Bonhoeffer was? Because we're always connected and always looking externally. He had to look internally to have this stuff happen. Where oftentimes technology causes you to look externally, looking for something else, connecting with somebody else. So what do you think? Does technology mitigate against that? Marilyn? Well, that's a good point, yeah. I don't know, could you say that again?
It was
Well, that's okay, it's good.
God is always chasing us. Sometimes we should stop and let him catch us.
Yeah, thank you, yeah.
Which is kind of what Jeff was talking about.
Yeah, yeah. I find myself not taking time to reflect and feeling guilty that I don't because I feel I should. And part of it's because of what you're saying, Jeff. Bobby.
Mm-hmm. Which I have only done twice, I think, but and it's very, I found it really hard to do because there is so much coming and incoming all the time. But if you can make some time in your life for that, I think that's a kind of a, I don't want to say an antidote because it's a long word, but that's a way of standing still long enough to find that internal thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, everybody has too much to do already, but speaking of discipline, I try to do something. I've been driving a lot lately, and I have started to turn off the radio in the car, so I just don't have anything, because I have like a 45-minute drive that I'm doing, and so just turn the radio off. So there is, you know, I'm not asleep, I have to pay, obviously, I'm driving.
We're thankful for that.
Something, some time when there isn't constantly something coming in.
Are you finding that is helping in terms of reflection and time to meditate?
Sometimes I think about the grocery list,
yeah.
You know, and, but at least it gives it, it's an opening.
Sure,
you know?
Cool. There's always something coming at us, wherever we happen to be. Cool, thank you. Anybody else? Let me ask that question a little differently then. These are neat poems, my bias, but I'd like to think that they still speak to us today. So let me ask this question related to this poem, and let's wrestle with it for a little bit. We've done some work on interpreting this poem in the last several minutes, but what do you think Bonhoeffer's message is for us in 2016? If he were standing here, not me, reading this poem, what do you think he would tell us that we can learn? And Jeff started us on that road a minute ago, so let's just keep that going a little bit. What kinds of things can we Christians in Allegheny and Washington County in 2016 be learning from what he has to say to us? What's the message?
And speaking for myself, I get stuck more on the action and feeling like I need to keep doing things. And I don't pay attention to the other parts. Now, I don't want to suffer, but the discipline would be a good thing. And I did do that constant discipleship years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I've completely, you know, I don't do any of that stuff anymore. And so it's just, you know, the discipline and really sort of preparing yourself that the fact that you are going to die as we age. Especially, you know, once I turn 65, that whole thing of more than half of my life is over now. And so, you know, maybe we have to look at the whole thing instead of just focusing in on one section.
Thank you. John.
I think when I'm reading some of these poems,
mm-hmm.
It's like Bonhoeffer is really talking to God. And it makes me think, you know, you can't do that on a cell phone. God doesn't have a cell phone, and you're not going to find his number there. And if you want to just use technology all the time, you're not going to have any of this going on.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to do with Bobby's the centering prayer or something where you can actually be quiet.
Disconnect.
I have a cell phone, I use it, but it doesn't work in that same sense.
Thank you. Others? Jeff, please. And then
a little park we go to down in West Virginia where they have no cell phone service, no TVs, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And we always spend maybe up to a week down there. And probably the only time you have the opportunity to just sit down and think without any outside influence is when you go to that park. Every place else the cell phone rings or something happens. I think that's something that we don't do often enough.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't this what Christ did?
What's that?
Discipline, action, suffering, death.
Sure sounds a lot like the gospel, doesn't it?
I mean, that's, to me, that's
Yeah.
That's what happened,
right? Yeah. And people didn't understand it when he died any more than they did when he was talking about death as the final form of freedom. Yeah. Donna?
And he listened. He was a good listener, and he knew what was around him, what was happening, even though he couldn't see it. He was aware of other people, and of their pain, as well as his own.
That's a really key point. I think he was engaged with others. Not that it's all about me, because it's certainly not all about me, but I do some reflecting when I read this. If I were in a prison cell, would I be able to be as engaged with others around me, or would I be worried about what are those footsteps coming down the hall mean for me? And he wondered that, but he was always constantly engaged with other people and praying for them and caring for them. So that's a key point. Thank you, Donna. Others? Heather? I think Charlie's seeing the connection with the gospel. For all intents, the day that Christ died, people thought he had failed. They were mocking him. I mean, he died. I mean, we have a beautiful cross there. Well, it's there. It's behind the thing. But it's by no means representing something beautiful. It represents a gruesome means of execution. He was executed at the hands of the Roman government, but that was what brought the freedom. And you just don't see it that way. And to compare that with what Bonhoeffer's talking about is really very powerful, because he ends with death, not with resurrection on here. It's through the death that you see the hope, that that's what the ultimate freedom is. And it's just a marvelous step, I think. So thanks for pointing that out. Bob.
We're talking a lot about being still Bonhoeffer, you know, reached out and obviously connected with other people. He was forced to spend, I'm sure, a lot of time alone with his life. And he turned it into a blessing, in a sense. You know, I always do that.
Yeah. I think he was. Others that survived and talked about him. And he talks in the letter that he wrote to Maria related to powers of good about how even separated from people, he was connected with them. There's a spiritual connection that he's talking about, and I find that helpful because there's a time in which you can't be connected. I think of folks that I see in the nursing home or folks that are seriously ill and they're disconnected from their friends and their loved one physically, geographically, but not emotionally and spiritually. And that causes a kind of hope. And he talks about that as well. Let me read just one sentence, two sentences. Hans Ulrich wrote a commentary on this poem, on Stations on the Road to Freedom. And he said, "In the powerlessness of the church, God's power becomes visible. The church steps in for the world by being involved in its affairs, which are transformed into God's affairs through the church's involvement." That's what he's talking about in terms of action and discipline. But he says in the poem, it really just leaped out at me this morning in a way it hadn't before. In the section on suffering, "A change has come indeed. Your hands, so strong and active, are bound. In helplessness now, you see your action is ended. The very next line says, you sigh in relief, your cause committing to stronger hands, so now you may rest contented. It keeps going because there are others to keep that message alive. And then for that one whose time to work is ended, come now, thou greatest of feasts, on the journey to freedom eternal. Death, cast aside all the burdens and chains. Always looking forward and looking to hope. We have just a few minutes left. I would like to read The Powers of Good as our closing. But before I do that, I want to give you an opportunity to, since next week we move to the Ku Klux Klan, to share any thoughts or insights you may have over these 4 weeks. Anybody have anything you'd like to share for the good of the order? That's really a wonderful way to stop a discussion and say, well, what do you think? And nobody knows what to do with that. But I don't know what's in your head, so I opened it that way. Quite possibly, sure.
So the economy of what he had available would lead him to go deeper in thought in a poem, a short poem, well, they're not all short, but I mean succinctly present his ideas.
That's
good
point.
My initial
well, but good, because we really don't know. So that's a good insight. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? Well, and I'll read The Powers of Good, and then we'll have a moment of prayer. I've been saying all along that heroes, at least my heroes, are most heroic to me, not because they have big red S's on their chest and a red cape. And it may sound like I'm contradicting that and talking about Bonhoeffer. I recognize his humanness. I recognize his arrogance, recognize that he was a sinner like the rest of us. But poems like this one that I'm about to read, I think it's important. It's his last poem before he was executed. He had at least two choices, I think. One was to look at the Nazis and shake his fist and be eternally angry, or have his hand open to God. And all of his poems, there's very little talk of anger toward the Nazis. It's openness toward God and how that God is helping him to get through all that the Nazis are making him go through. That, I think, is a powerful message, a powerful way of looking at faithfulness in dangerous times. His last poem before he was executed is called Powers of Good, not Kill the Nazis. And I think that's an important distinction. So let me read that, and then we'll have a time of prayer. This is his very last poem. With every power for good to stay and guide me, comforted and inspired beyond all fear, I'll live these days with you in thought beside me and pass with you into the coming year. He wrote this just before the new year. The old year still torments our hearts unhastening. The long days of our sorrow still endure. Father, grant to the souls thou hast been chastening that thou hast promised the healing and the cure. Should it be ours to drain the cup of grieving even to the dregs of pain at thy command, we will not falter, thankfully receiving all that is given by thy loving hand. But should it be thy will once more to release us to life's enjoyment and its good sunshine, that which we've learned from sorrow shall increase us, and all our life be dedicated as thine. Today let candles shed their radiance, their radiant greeting. Lo, on our darkness are they not thy light? Leading us haply to our longed-for meeting, thou canst illumine even for our darkest night. When now the silence deepens for our hearkening, grant we may hear thy children's voices raise. From all the unseen world around us darkening their universal pain in their praise. while all the powers of good aid and attend us, boldly we'll face the future, come what may. At even and at morn, God will befriend us, and oh, most surely, on each newborn day. Let's pray. Eternal God, we are grateful for your love and your care. We're grateful for witnesses such as Dietrich Bonhoeffer that help us to not only wrestle with our faith, but to catch a fresh glimpse of your eternal hope and love that sees us through difficult and dangerous times. We're grateful for these weeks we've been together and for the ability to share with one another and for your presence through it all. And would ask that you would send us forth as your faithful disciples, confident in the same hope that Bonhoeffer knew, and engaged with the same active engagement that he sought. Each of our prayers we offer to you in Jesus' name. Amen.